Welcome to the New Urban Architect Podcast, a collection of interviews with design professionals about the role of architecture within new urbanism.
Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Brant Hay. It's great to have as our guest today, Kenneth Hitchens. Ken is an architect based in Florida, but his work within architecture and new urbanism takes him literally all over the globe. Ken, lately you've been blogging a lot, and you've been blogging about a concept you like to call EX-DX-LX. Now, most of us probably think of cars when we hear that, but is it safe to assume that you're actually referring to something entirely different?
You know, I'm going to give Fumazon a little bit of credit here. When he first started talking about and then writing about the classical to vernacular range and how you can create a lot of variety within a very narrow band, and that's one of the reasons that you go to a place and all of a sudden you can see that that place has a certain character to it that is unique to itself. And while each house might be subtly different, it's still, you know, the collection together is evocative of that particular place or that particular time. And then in developing the architectural pattern books to bring that theory into to reality as far as how we can operate and bring some of that knowledge back into current usage, it became apparent that the most vernacular was actually a very expensive way to build today, whereas the mid-range was actually the least expensive, which goes to explain why builders who normally go for the most cost-effective way have been using that. And in so doing, I noticed, you know what you could do with this is if you establish what the most cost-effective is, you don't necessarily have to be stuck with that on that particular residence or building or whatever for its entire lifespan. You can actually start off with that most cost-effective, and then you can start layering on detail over time. And it's not too dissimilar to the way that, you know, people will purchase cars. They have the base model, they have the mid-level trim, and then they have the luxury version. And in recent times, they've even gone one step above in the case of, say, Lexus, Infiniti, and Acura, where, you know, not only is the EX, DX, and LX not enough, they've also gone one step further with, you know, the same, you know, same chassis and components, and created the another level of luxury trim on top of that. So people are predisposed to conceiving of, you know, their car in such a way that, you know, okay, well, they've got they've got the base model, they've got the mid level, and so on. And so when taking a look at a number of the houses that we were building at the Waters of Montgomery at that time, you know, we were looking at the variation, and the variation could come on the porch. And so you're looking at something that could be as simple as just a square post. Then maybe that square post gets some eased edges with the notion of a capital. And then maybe that that eased edged post gives way to an actual turned column. And then the same approach can be had with the pickets and the railing. The same approach can be had with the reveal on the weatherboards. So you're looking at the clapboard siding, instead of having, you know, a 6-inch reveal, a larger might go down to a 4. And then all of a sudden there's all these different ways to articulate the expression of the building that is above and beyond just, you know, having to scrape the ground and start over. And then when taking that a little bit deeper, it's like, okay, well, if you set up a street and it was all, you know, of the base model, and even, say, a base unit as far as floor plan that could be added onto. So you start with that base model with the base floor plan, and it doesn't have to keep its station over time. That house can grow over time, and then it can increase its trim level over time with a level of detailing. And so it can make the jump from EX to DX to LX. Now, if that house can do it, if all the houses on the street did that, then all of a sudden you can take that street and take it to the next level. And if you take the street to the next level, then you're also looking at, you know, potentially the neighborhood. You know, you take the block and then the neighborhood. And one of the things that I've noticed is that in today's practice, just the massive developments being built, is that you are looking really at a development that will be stuck in place and time and price point. So if it's conceived of as starter housing or conceived of as affordable housing, that neighborhood can't make the jump. When you take a look at some of the, you know, the traditional urbanism that has been around in this country, the opportunity there to, you know, rehab a neighborhood, rehab a street, rehab a house, and you know, bring it back to its former luster or take it to the next level is there. And so you have this operating system that allows it to continue to improve over time, improve its station over time, improve the property values of the neighborhood, of the house and of the street, and all of a sudden you have this really elegant way of assessing, you know, a property, a street, or what have you, and taking it to that level, making sure that it remains relevant to whatever time it's currently in. And without that, you know, what we're seeing now, especially with the devastation in the housing industries economically, is that a number of areas are just going to remain empty. There's nothing else you can do with that land form. There's nothing else you can do with that urban form. There's nothing else you can do with that house form. And they will wind up becoming the slums, you know, because the only thing you can do is scrape and start over. And that is so costly, it's just not worth it unless the property happens to be in an absolutely stellar location.
You make a good point about suburban subdivisions typically being stuck in time and unable to evolve as the needs of their occupants change. What exactly is it about suburban sprawl and these conventional subdivisions that prevents them from being able to adapt as needs change?
Well, really what has happened is when development became a formalized industry, they were very good at not leaving anything left on the table for anybody else to come and make money off of. So they weren't, when they went into a place, they were always looking for highest and best use. So they would, and they were also looking for the path of least resistance. And so you go into a place, you have one thoroughfare type, one roadway type, right? Boom, you get that roadway type approved, and then you just lay that out everywhere. You know, you have one cul-de-sac type, and it's like, okay, does that meet the fire? Boom. So they simplified the model to just the bare essentials. They went in there and they find out what was, you know, what do they think the sweet spot of the market was, right? And then they convinced everybody through, you know, pretty good marketing campaigns that's what you need, and that's because it's a wonderful investment. And if you don't have this, then you won't be able to resell it, and you might not think that you're going to resell, but you're going to have to someday. And there's this whole you know, rigmarole that that then, you know, led to the carpeting of America with this this one housing, this one size fits all housing type. It was really interesting is to see the difference between the $200,000 home neighborhood and a $300,000 home neighborhood, you know, and then the $300,000 to the $500,000, the $500,000 to the million. And in a number of instances, it's like, you know, okay, they got a couple, you know, awkwardly proportioned columns out front and a portcullis. They have, you know, a little bit taller ceilings, and they have a couple more rooms. Okay, maybe the rooms are a little bit bigger, but, you know, as far as the level of finishes and everything else, there was nothing much different about these houses. And I think that it had to do with the financing, and also the division, because the industry stratified where you have the land developers, the infrastructure, you know, the developers, and then the builders. So what you have is somebody that buys the wrong land, goes through the process of getting the property zoned for its intended use, and then they're out of the deal. Then the person takes the zoned property, puts in all the infrastructure, and then they sell down the lots to the builders. And then they're out of the deal. And then the builders take over in the case of some larger builders, and, you know, they build their houses on top of it. And so when you take a look at that process, the person doing the rezoning of the property, their intended market is people that are looking to put the infrastructure into the property. And they want, you know, a certain amount of you know, density and return, what have you. People to put the infrastructure, they're looking to sell to the builders. And the builders are looking to, you know, you'd hope they were looking to sell to the homeowners. But in a number of instances, especially in the last 5-10 years, it was to people that were going to be buying a home with the intent of holding onto it for a little bit and then reselling it to somebody else, and never actually occupying the home. So the builders were catering to the investors and not necessarily the homeowner. So you wind up with a number of homes that just are unlivable as far as their floor plan is concerned, being put on the market. And so you have that division where, you know, it's not a cohesive, you know, unit working towards let's build houses for the people that are going to live there. And instead, you know, they they wound up just building houses that could, you know, attract other investors. And I think that's led to a certain devolution, and that's why you have a unit type out there that isn't necessarily the best thing in the world, but it's been stamped all over the place because it was quick, it was inexpensive to build, and it was easy to get approvals. And so at the, you know, at the end of the day, the ultimate goal for a number of those types of suburban developers wasn't necessarily creating the best house and the best community for the people that are going to live there.
You brought up a great point when you mentioned the difference between a consumer buyer and an investment buyer, because in recent years, we've had a sort of smoke and mirror show, it seems, in terms of what do people actually want. When you think about builders and developers, they spend so much money on market research, and it's all based on a hypothetical, theoretical buyer that may or may not even exist. And in recent years, the people who buy the houses that are built have very often not been anything like the people that all of the market research was geared towards. They've been investors, and investors have had their own idea that may or may not align with the market research about what kind of buyer would want to buy this house. And then the investors turned around the house to someone else who was an investor. And so in this recent era, the consumer has really gotten lost, and it's been really hard to identify what the consumer wants and needs. And when you get down to it, that really does need to be discovered. Because that need, that want, that demand of the consumer is what the whole system is based on.
I think so. You know, and first and foremost, let's go back to the builders again, because one of the things that is interesting, because of that stratification where you have the, you know, where the money is made by the different participants in the delivery of housing, where does the land developer make money and where does the builder make money? And where the builder makes money is on the square footage of the house, because that's, you know, how properties are appraised, right? So you get the appraised value based on square footage. A lot of people that have been starting the process of designing smaller, smarter homes, you know, have realized that by cutting out the extra rooms, you're not saving a whole lot, because that's the cheap space. You know, the bathrooms and the kitchens are expensive. And so a lot of the builders would go in there and, you know, and build more of this cheap space, because they're still getting it valued at, you know, $150 a square foot, $200 a square foot, $300 a square foot. So that's, you know, their lottery ticket to a certain extent, and that's where they get caught. And so there has to be a rethinking of the model in order to be able to bring prices down, where you're dealing with something that's more of a, you know, vertical delivery method, where you have somebody that's making money off the property and the house, so that they can get, you know, get the price in line and get the size of the house in line with what the market is looking for. And what winds up happening is, because they are selling the cheap space, they're putting that dollar on the interior of the house and not so much the exterior of the house. And also because of how the communities are laid out from just an urban planning point of view, where you're setting up, you know, those kind of, you know, class rivalries between the $200,000 guy, the $300,000 guy, and the $400,000 guy. And, you know, Andres Duany talks about that, you know, has some great slides showing it. It becomes more about the entry feature to the enclave than it does about the actual house itself, because the difference between the houses really aren't that great. But what they have been doing is they've been dumbing down the exterior of the houses. They've been dumbing down the construction of the houses in that effort to add more space, because, you know, if it's going to cost $60 a square foot to build, and you're going to be looking at, you know, say $6,000 to put some extra trim on the house or put a nice, you know, porch with turned columns on the house, or you can, you know, have one more 100 square foot room, you know, because of the valuation of the property based on the square footage, you build the extra room. And so all of a sudden there's this, you know, this race to the bottom that you can see from, you know, the 50s, 60s, 70s on down, where all of a sudden, you know, they took money out of, you know, the windows, they took money out of the trim, they took money out of everywhere on the house so they can add more square footage, because that's where the value for these suburban neighborhoods come from. When you have like a mature community with existing traditional architecture and that, you know, there's a different way of valuing those properties because you have, you know, the houses have been around forever and there's plenty of precedent in the property appraisers' roles. But with these new developments, that's the way to get the extra money. And that dovetailed perfectly with the drive to qualify, where if you built your community just a little bit further out, where the property price is a little bit cheaper, or maybe you were outside of a on the other side of a specific boundary where the taxes were lower, you know, you could coax people out there because they had an extra room. They had a 4-bedroom house, 5-bedroom house, or something else. And people, when they had to make the choice, you know, chose schools. They want to be in a good school district. They want the extra space. They want the extra yard. And it was the perception of value that the larger house offered. You know, that notion that you're getting your piece of the good life. The only thing is once that that commute turned from a half hour to an hour to an hour and a half, all of a sudden that, you know, that kind of upset the apple cart there.
Do you think people sometimes actually like buying things that are ugly?
You know, I think there's a certain amount of pride in the fact that that you're buying something that you're not necessarily buying it because it's ugly, but you're buying it because of the perception of value versus the actual value. Being somewhat anti-snobbish, right? You know, so I don't necessarily need this, you know, pretty whatever, you know, this pretty widget. You know, I can make do with this. And there's a little bit of self-reliance in there, but there's also because of the amount of the effective use of class warfare in marketing, anything, right, these days, from weight loss programs to shampoo, it's become an effective tool. So we have a society that's been marketed to so much that that they attach certain values to certain things. If somebody has something that's, you know, attractive and nice, then maybe they're just a snob, or maybe they overpaid for it too, you know. And you can kind of see that in a lot of the big box retailers. They have a conundrum. You know, they have gotten to the point where they don't have fancy stores, they don't have carpeting, they don't have special rooms in the back. They have everything out on the shelves, and it's almost this, you know, public self-flagellation, you know that we are going to suffer and just be in this ugly warehouse building so we can pass the savings on to you. And in a number of instances, the cost of building that structure that way is no less expensive or more expensive than if they would have built a nicer structure. But it's that being very public about showing something that is unattractive, so you know people can visually connect with the fact that yes, they aren't building something, you know, some expensive department store in a mall situation. So therefore, I'm going to save more money there because they're saving money on their facilities. And then after convincing people that they need to buy in an ugly place, well, then they want them to go in there and buy 5-gallon drum of shampoo, because they're getting a tremendous value on that by buying in bulk or something of that particular nature. So it goes back to that notion. It's probably going to become even more pronounced in the next couple of years, you know, because of the current financial situation, where people are saving money, every possible way they can, and all of a sudden, you know, there's a certain nobility that comes with, you know, also being the person that's saving money. So you can go out and treat yourself to, you know, a finer quality shampoo or a finer quality widget because you're worth it, because you have come to this place, which isn't the best environment, so you can save money for your family, and you're the one that's doing this, you know, wonderful thing and suffering for it. And for all your suffering and for all your caring about other people, you deserve this wonderful yogurt, or you deserve to treat yourself to this, you know, wonderful, piece of chocolate here at the counter. And it really kind of skews things a little bit because it gets back to that notion of perception of value, you know, because when you think of the time lost, people wind up having to provision once a week, you know, how they have to change their life in order to accommodate this type of way of saving money, or being the family hero. As opposed to spending more time with the family, spending, you know, less time commuting back and forth from work, and what it entails to do that. Now, you know, it comes back to, you know, are you going to be the person that's going to go into one of these existing neighborhoods and ride it out, you know, and hope that the schools improve, you know, in specific situations? Are you going to be the one that goes out there and you actually have time on the weekends to work on the house yourself, or are you going to contract that work out to bring that existing house to, the next level? You know, in some cases, that next level might just be livable in some of these other areas. And so they make that judgment. You know, it's easier right now to just go out to the suburbs, buy a place, and then do the whole, you know, commute thing mentally for a lot of people than to go through the process of, you know, finding a nice neighborhood, either building a house or taking an existing house and make renovations to it. you know, you can see why people would make that decision, and the options aren't always available, to everybody, which is I think why a lot of us are new urbanists out there, because we want to provide those options for those people so that they actually do have something that we value in this country and all over the world, which is choice, right? And that's one thing that is just not available on the market right now, is that anytime somebody is forced into buying into suburbia, most of the time it's because they don't have a choice, because of the one-size-fits-all and, you know, everybody playing the same game. So you can't necessarily, beat up the consumer because, they have two bad choices to choose from. To me, that's just an opportunity to create that variety in the marketplace, where it's legal, and to give them another option. And then what we found, everywhere is that when you do give that option, that people just that take it. They take that option over every other when presented with it.
Another dynamic I've come across, which really fascinates me, is the reaction of people to a good T&D. Good T&Ds completely blow away their suburban competition, even at the same price point. But I encounter people who say that they would not live in one because it's too nice. Too nice. It's fascinating.
Well, it is, and it's kind of crazy because they don't, because of how they've been programmed, I guess they're through their life, they don't necessarily feel like they could be comfortable there. Which is almost sad, in that respect. They don't feel they are worthy of living in one of these nice places, or that it doesn't suit their particular lifestyle. In some respects, because of the format, might not necessarily suit all their needs, but the reality is, because of the variety within any T&D, there is usually a unit type that will accommodate them and their lifestyle, perfectly. So, and if it isn't in there, then they have an opportunity to go talk to somebody. And I'm sure, especially now, if you say that, hey, I need, X, Y, and Z here, that there'd be a number of people saying, wow, that's great, and there's probably a lot more people like you, so let's go ahead and develop that unit type. And, but it's just really, it's really interesting, especially because a lot of T&D use an architecture that is very humble, very vernacular. At one time, was considered the architecture of the poor, right? And so now you have a portion of society that thinks the architecture of the poor is too good for them, because these were kid homes that came from Sears that developed a lot of precedent for the adoption of, say, Craftsman style homes, some of the old farmhouses throughout the Midwest and what have you. So you're dealing with a situation where these were kid built homes that were inexpensive back in the 20s and 30s. And now there's taking that aesthetic and advancing it today, and people are like, oh, whoa, that's too snobby for me. And it's like, wow, you've got to be kidding. That right there is just that's sad. The true American type of house that has been developed throughout the country is now considered beyond the reach of Mr. and Mrs. America. This new form of development, which was imposed upon the U.S. by our supposed European betters, in a form of the Walter Gropius of the GSD, like Corbusier, and his Radiant City, and all these other architectural philosophers saw in America the chance to start again with a blank canvas. And how many people you have now buying into this failed European notion of what America should be, and ignoring what perhaps the best solution to sprawl, which was an American invention, and yet they defend the European vision, which is what we know as the European vision for America, which is the sprawl, and they defend that as our right, and this is so American, blah blah blah, and it's like you haven't done the reading. And there's no better way of destroying our economy, destroying our people, than via the waistlines and everything else, than this particular vision for America, which is not of American origin.
Well, Ken, thanks so much for coming on the show and talking to us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been great fun.
Thanks for listening to the New Urban Architect Podcast, produced by W. Brandt Hay Architect. Check us out on the web at newurbanarchitect.com.